Are your parents PhDs?
Yeah, biology.
Both of them?
There's this like Chinese exchange program where they sent Chinese academics to get PhDs in the U.S.
You were telling me about this a little bit when we met up. Oh, interesting.
So your parents are biology PhDs and you decided to go into math?
In high school, they were really pushing the science angle. My older sister took the brunt of it and they were like, be a doctor. And she was like, all right, fine, I'll be a doctor. I remember in high school for a science fair project, they were like, all right, come and do some CR, do a bunch of science, biology stuff. And it's all just lab work, which is honestly just labor. And I hated it and it sucked. And I was like, I'm not touching this.
You can't write code that repeats a lab experiment, unfortunately.
Let's start with utility. I don't understand what it even means.
Everybody has some kind of utils in their head that they're calibrating.
There's hardly anything that hasn't been used for money.
In fact, there may be a fundamental problem in modeling that we don't want to model.
Right, here we are. The boys are back. It is episode 8, Game Economist Cast. I am joined today, Philip Black, the host of Game Economist Cast, with my two other wonderful hosts. Chris, how are you?
Star Atlas, we just launched a test of movement on blockchain, which is very exciting. So been busy with that.
You're repping Purdue College University sweatshirt as well.
Which is funny because I was at this weekend, I was at my alma mater for my undergraduate, UW Oshkosh, and they gave me some merch, but it was all medium, and I'm not a medium-sized person.
Wait, they didn't let you pick the size?
No, they did, but I was like in a rush as I was leaving. They were like, you can go return this. Like, I was like, I don't have time, so I just gave it to my wife, and now it's like an oversized hoodie for her. Nice.
A hand-me-down.
Yeah.
Eric, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Can't complain.
The first topic we'll be discussing is the announcement that EVE Online, the infamous 4X space game, is going into crypto. Going into Web3, what does it mean for EVE to be on the blockchain? What are they cooking up? Why does it make sense or not make sense for EVE to be on the blockchain? And then we're also going to be talking about the economics of streaming and subscriptions in the wake of the Activision, Microsoft fallout. The CMA out of the UK, the regulatory authority, has blocked the merger. While we don't have anything interesting to say about the legal prospects, we, of course, have a lot to say about the economic process. But before we do, let's talk about what we've been playing.
Got a selection of good things on sale, stranger.
Yeah, Eric, what have you been playing?
Play a lot of Dominion. You know that card game? It's a classic from 2008 or something. But yeah, I met up with some old friends from Chicago. We played a bunch of Dominion in person and online lately. The online interface is great. They've really improved it. But yeah, for those of you who don't know, this is like the classic deck builder. This is the one that really kind of broke the mold and inspired, you know, everyone knows probably Slay the Spire, like all these deck builder roguelikes that are out these days, but this one of the OG inspiration, I think, for a lot of them.
I disagree that it still holds up, but I'm curious. So I totally agree. I think it's like the first deck builder. I played it in college too. I was okay with it. I didn't mind it, but then I started to play a lot more of the, or some of the more elegant, kind of refined card games, deck builders, like physical deck builders. You should play it. It's a one deck, two player deck builder. So you've got this like kind of this deck that essentially you could think of the shop coming from it. So you lay out, I think it's 5 or 6 cards into the shop and you select cards from there. So you've got your currency, you've got your attack, you've got your like 4 or 5 core mechanics. But it's like, literally, you slap the deck on the board. And that was always my problem with Dominion, was that you've got 10 piles of different cards and you're always fucking shuffling your... Anyway, I love how just you slap this thing out, put the shop there, and you're ready to go. One of the things I love about deck builders is just how equal the footing is at the beginning. It's not like Magic the Gathering, where you have this awkward meta playing and every single match, it's like, oh, he's got like a slow blue deck. He's about to lose to this fast red burn deck. It's like, everybody's got the same exact odds starting off from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's why I love Magic Draft. I know you guys like Draft, but you know, the problem with...
Have you played any of Clash Royale's drafting? Or even now Clash Royale? I've been obsessed with many.
But yeah, I mean, that setup and shuffle up, you know, the beauty of online, right? I think that's a lot of why deck building works so well on computer games, is because, you know, you don't have to shuffle anything.
Yeah. There's one deck builder I've played that doesn't have any shuffling, and I think it's really an interesting game. Like, the whole idea is that you're like actually putting the cards in the right order, the order that you want, so that when they come back up, you just flip your graveyard upside down to make the new deck. It's called, I completely forgot what it was called. I'm just talking about it. It's a bigger one. It's more involved, but yeah, I totally agree. I like...
Just name a bunch of games. I'll edit it in.
Oh, shit. I'll later in the episode, when I remember it, I'll just say it out loud and then we can...
Chris, what have you been playing?
So
another indie thriller.
No, I think I said one weird game once, and now I get it every single time.
What was it? Turmeric? What was the
Tunic? Tunic.
Tunic's amazing. Yeah
that's like a triple A game.
Contender for game of the year.
Yeah, that doesn't count as it.
Anytime I see one of those like isometric, like high fidelity 2D art, I'm like, I'm out.
Dude, if you like old Legend of Zelda, I highly recommend Tunic. I've been playing it. So
see, I think the isometric is important, especially if we're going to be talking about streaming game. Like, reduce the quality of the game. The stream is easier. You don't have to have some crazy shoot like gigabit connection speed in order to get like the high quality. I am pro double A like game quality. Like, I'm pro isometric, pro low poly game design. I think all these triple A super high fidelity game environments are just so difficult to build, and it slows down innovation, but that's a different topic.
Mr. Star Atlas himself. Don't worry about that.
So I have been playing once again, of course, Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak came out 2 days ago on the Xbox. I've been playing that a little bit, but I don't know if I could say I'm playing it because it's not really a game, but I have been playtesting the Star Atlas. Internally, we call it the movement test, but it's the Star Atlas. I think it's called Escape Velocity. It's basically just testing movement, real-time, massively multiplayer online movement on the blockchain. So bunch of players have their little fleets, and you can have multiple fleets and you direct them, warp them around the galaxy. And to make things more interesting, my team designed a loot table for the galaxy. So it's a universal loot table spread across all the different planets. It's a fun challenge because a lot of game design is like intra-player or like within the player. So the player goes and they get their shards and then they get their sword. So this was a little tougher to balance because we've got 10,000 players and we've got, 100,000 prizes or 50,000 prizes. We need to make sure that those are like spread out appropriately. So it's been really cool to test it out. It's like from a Web3 point of view, it's a big deal because I think we put within the first 24 hours, we put well over 1 million transactions on the Solana blockchain just in movement. So
is it a game?
I didn't think it was a game, but then the players started playing it and they were getting all excited and like they were posting the loot they were finding. I was like, the loot was just supposed to be kind of like an incentive to move because it was really just a test. We wanted to test the technology, make sure that it's working. So we were like, we'll add in prizes. And like, it's been a hit. I can't believe how much everybody is enjoying it.
I saw a tweet that it was something like, was it 2-5% of all Solana transactions?
2.5%
week since it came out?
Yep, 2.5%. Which we typically were at, I think 0.7%. So it's a pretty big jump for us for one very simple program. It's been a shock to me, like just how much people have enjoyed it, but also how exciting it is to start finally gathering some of this data. A lot of the data we have is from what our product, which is called Score, which is load your ship up with fuel and then you get a reward. And it's not that interesting. So this is pretty fun to see like locational movement and like see how the loot distribution works. I think I did a pretty good job on the loot table, if I do say so myself, but I'll let somebody else pat me on the back.
Can I ask what you actually do? What is the moment-to-moment a player experiences when they're going to...
Very, very simple. Like that, why I said I don't even know if I would say I've been playing a game is because we don't really consider it a game. We consider it a test, a mechanical test. But you have three options. You can scan an area that you're in, which will allow you to get your little loot. So if you scan and there's a loot in the area, then you get a piece of loot. And the loot drops according to a probability distribution, and it drops in a fixed number of spaces. So basically, at any given time, the map is populated with prizes. And that's hard capped at a per minute prize, like number of prizes. So we don't end up like draining the pool in 2 seconds. You move to a space using the warp action. So you can warp with 3 or 4 spaces of your ship. You go there, scan. If there's nothing there, maybe you scan again, or maybe you move to another spot. We show the density of players on the map. So you probably, like from a strategic point of view, you probably want to be on an empty space because if there are 20 other people scanning in your location, you got a 1 in 20 chance when it drops.
Wouldn't equilibrium be that the map is completely equal distributed, assuming that the rewards are randomly distributed in the map?
It should be. And we do see a very consistent spread. I think one of the guys saw that there's like a left bias on the map, like people are tending to the left side of the map instead of the right side or something like that. But you know, the problem is like when people leave their ships, they sometimes don't despawn them. So you have to despawn your ship in order to get it out of the environment. So if you don't do that, it just sits there because it's on a blockchain. So it's like, it'll show up. So that also causes it to get a little weird. And other people have different strategies. And I think it's really funny because we'll have people who are like, oh, this is my strategy. I like keep 100 ships on the same space and I just scan every second. It's like, wow, I didn't know that was a strategy, but so it's cool. It's like very cool to find this, see this working. And it's like a billionth of the, it's a fraction of the actual game design.
Why are they not acting in a way that we'd expect from just a traditional neoclassical model where they're equally distributed? Well, like if there are gains to moving to a space that's less populated, and it seems like there are, why would they be clumping on the left? Why would they not be equally distributed?
Opportunity cost of time. So it takes time to travel. I think each warp action is like 30 seconds or something like that. So if you're moving five spaces over 30 seconds, you might just like circle within a little thing. And if every once in a while I get intersected by somebody, I think it's a lot more coordination than you might expect. The second somebody comes into my area, oh God, am I going to move? I'm probably going to stick around. So I think it all has to do with like costs, like marginal costs of like moving or changing my strategy. It's just not worth it. So I think it is still neoclassical though.
By and large, it's following the traditional homo economic model.
I did a whole bunch of different simulations to try and predict different outcomes so I could properly value the loot table, you know, because I don't want it to be too big. I don't want it to be too small. So I ran a bunch of different simulations so I could see what does this distribution look like over time. And I'm really happy because like it's all within my this like bandwidth.
On my side, I have been stuffing my face in a buffet of what has been called squad RPGs on mobile. So think of games like Marvel Strike Force, AFK Arena. I've been playing a new one that's come out called Eternal Evolution. I've been going back and playing a game I used to play a long time ago, don't judge me, called Girls X Battle. It was for work. I was studying it. And I don't know what to make of this genre. I've always been confused what to make of this genre. But the basic core loop is that you have a squad of characters. The characters have a deep roster of stats. So they have things like shield, health, armor, attack speed, critical strike chance. So they just have a litany of stats, and you're assembling a team of these different characters. There's usually a campaign mode, but what happens as you continue to play is that you are unlocking more and more modes. And what you're doing is that you're upgrading your characters, you're expanding your roster. The thing that's interesting about it is that there's almost zero real-time input. So when you start a battle against an enemy squad or against the computer, there's no input by and large. Some games allow you to have a tap that you can use to activate like a character's ultimate ability, but by and large, the outcome is determined before the match even starts. And in many cases, you can actually skip the battle loop. So rather than going in and watching the units attack one another, you just click one button, you're collecting your rewards, you're moving on. So it's very much a question of vertical progression and managing power score and upgrading your characters, just making them better off. And of course, what they'll do is that each of the modes that you continue to unlock as you're playing these squad RPGs will require or incentivize you to have different characters to be able to progress in that mode and then ultimately get the rewards that are locked within that mode. So for instance, you might get into a particular mode that takes advantage of what almost all of the games have, which is Rochambeau, so rock, paper, scissors, shoot. And so if you are playing this particular mode, it might be all leaf types that you're going against. And if you want to do well in this mode, you are best off when you field five fire types. And so they're going to do all these things that are going to require you to collect an ever-growing roster of characters. And of course, like each character represents a amount of content. Like if I need one additional character at the margin, that one additional character may require 30 hours of gameplay. They have started to converge on a lot of different modes in these squad RPGs, ones that weren't there 5 or 10 years ago. The thing that I've really seen emerge, and we were talking about at the top of the hour, is there's a lot of roguelike elements. There's a number of modes, and almost every one of these games have them now, where you're taking your squad of characters, you're going into a session in this roguelike mode, and you're getting upgrades for your squad within the context of the mode. So you might get to, let's say, the 30th floor in this roguelike mode. You'll have a number of additional power-ups within that session, and then you'll get to a place where you lose, and you're going to lose all those power-ups. And so then in a couple of days, you're going to need to do the roguelike mode over again. The thing I'm struggling with is why this experience is compelling at all. And I would say that's one thing. I would say the second is what you do when you reach endgame, which is something that I've seen all of these games really struggle with, is that, okay, I have a bunch of characters. I've maxed them out. I've gotten to ascension. You almost run out of vertical progression runway. And almost all of these games really struggle with what to do when you've run out of vertical progression runway. So one of the games, Mobile Legends Adventure, they have a gear system. So each of the characters have 5 slots. You would know armor and chest piece and swords. You'll have these gems, which is like basically another 5 units of gear. And then they have this other thing, which are cards, which is another 5 units of gear. So it just looks like excuses to add numbers and to make the numbers bigger. And so at that point, I basically churn. And I see Marvel Strike Force struggle with the same thing, which is that you have this ISO 8 thing. So you have your characters have these stars. Stars are related to power level. Okay, I get to 5 stars, and then I can go back and I earn a 6 star. Okay, I can go up to 10 stars. So they just struggle with what to do with the vertical progression. It's a content treadmill, and it starts to become uninteresting. You don't know what to do with this genre.
Yeah, isn't this super common, like, progressions? You know, everything from Puzzle and Dragons to gacha games is the same model, right? It's numbers go up, numbers keep going up. You roll this, collect a bunch of heroes, you know, P is strong. Yeah, I'm curious what's... You mentioned that it's like puzzling to you, but I feel like this is a pretty common thing in mobile games, right?
Like, the layer of choice that you're making is really what to invest in. That's really the key here is, do I want to invest in, let's say, light type characters? I have to have an intuition that light type characters are going to give me a lot of ROI. And so I'm min-maxing, right? So each unit of labor I put into the game, I want to maximize the amount of progression that unit of labor gets me. And so that's where you go with these games, is trying to figure out what that answer is. And a lot of it, when you get to the end game, is based on PvP. So what is the PvP meta? How do I build a roster that is competitive in PvP? The struggle I've seen is that the game designers usually don't lock as many rewards as you would like them to behind PvP. So why do I want to maximize the meta? Because you need that PvP to get that interesting equilibrium, right? To say, okay, the meta right now is all leaf type characters. I need fire type. That is content. And I don't think they're leaning enough on that PvP thing. On the other hand, Eric, I think it's just because collecting rewards and just powering up, it's like fucking fun. It's just a hit of dopamine.
So what's the difference between this genre and like auto battlers, auto chess?
Different. When people say auto battler, it means a few different things. I think the progression auto battle, it's you take, you know, Fire Emblem Heroes or your Puzzle and Dragons, just turn the puzzle into an auto battle. I think auto chess, I would call it a drafting auto battler. It's, you know, more like a roguelike or a drafting game where everyone starts on the same level. It's session based. And so you start with nothing and you accumulate your team over the course of the play session and it resets at the end.
Well, the whole time you were talking, Phil, I was just like PvP, PvP, like, especially with this like whole vertical progression issue. And then they start to go horizontal. It's like, well, like PvP is a really great opportunity to do that and not have people churn, because instead of like the dopamine hit and vertical progression is getting better, the dopamine hit for PvP is winning. I'm like, that's how you keep it going. It's really fascinating that they haven't, you know, obviously I'm thinking about Magic the Gathering Arena right now. Once you hit that level, you're right. Like, you constantly are updating the meta, you're coming out with new cards, you're making things, people are constantly, you know, given excuses to spend money, and you don't really need this constant need. You don't have this constant need for vertical progression. So somebody needs to build it.
Eve, blockchain, it's happening. Someone at A16Z came with a pile of money and flew over to Iceland and dropped it somewhere in Reykjavik.
$40
million. $40
million. I mean, it's huge news for the blockchain gaming industry. That's, to me, that's my main takeaway, right? What's going to happen to CP? What's going to happen to EVE Online? Is this going to be a product that actually gets released? Is A16Z going to get a return on their investment? Those are all questions we can speculate about. And I think it's really interesting to think about, but to me, at the end of the day, no matter what, this was overall good for the blockchain industry or the Web3 industry. It shows that a highly veteran, highly qualified studio studio was willing to take this on and try to implement this, and that there's still money in blockchain or new money in blockchain. You know, that kind of sticks out is the fact that Hilmar was pretty ambiguous about the implementation. So I'm trying to look for a quote. He said a couple of things. Together, we share the belief that player ownership and governance within an open platform could be a key source of fun that serves to amplify great gameplay and captivating game design. So this is, that was the Andreessen Horowitz announcement. But basically, Hilmar, now with advancements made with blockchain, we can forge a new universe deeply imbued with our expertise and player agency and autonomy, empowering players to engage in new ways. Empowering players to engage in new ways. What does that mean? Like profit-seeking behavior, like this secondary marketplace, open economy thing that everybody's talking about. Presumably that is what they're talking about. They're talking about opening up the EVE Online environment, turning ISK into a cryptocurrency, turning those assets in EVE Online into NFTs, most likely. I think it'll be a really interesting project to watch. I hope they have a lot more progress than most other blockchain games when they announce funding have, mainly because I want to see how this business model plays out. I think there's a lot of ambiguity right now about whether the transaction fee revenue model is feasible. You know, like we know the premium model is feasible. We know the free-to-play model is feasible. Is the transaction fee revenue model feasible? I don't think we really know that quite yet. I've always looked at it. You can think of like players having this, each player having a willingness to spend on the product. This is essentially their marginal utility for the item or for the game. And they're going to spend that no matter what, as long as you allow them to. So with premium games, you miss out a lot on some of the consumer surplus because you have a fixed price. And you don't let people spend $120, $200 if they want to. The free-to-play model fixes this by allowing people to spend whatever they want. The question is then with the transaction model, do we still let those people who want to spend more money, or are we leaving consumer surplus on the table? I think that's a big question that we have to ask ourselves. And to me, this whole announcement, this whole EVE Online thing is an exciting foray into answering that question. We could talk about CP and EVE Online and their community and some of the community is having over the fact that EVE is moving into blockchains. I don't know how worthwhile that is. I will comment one thing I found hilarious on the Twitter announcement in there was an EVE Online veteran saying, "I am infuriated by this announcement. I'm going into EVE right now and I'm going to sell all my assets on the secondary gray market." Which I'm not saying that a blockchain is going to make us make you a millionaire if you're an EVE millionaire, but that's the point, buddy. The whole point of this is, hey, you can take those assets and you go on the marketplace and you can trade them, which I think it is going to be a value add for the players. But it's really interesting because to me, it also emphasized just the depth of this divide between blockchain, non-blockchain. You say blockchain and people get pissed off, even if there's no reason for them to be pissed off. Hey, dude, you could go sell your assets for like a much easier way with far fewer transaction costs than you would have to if you're going to go sell your assets on Facebook Marketplace or something. I don't know how people trade, really.
If I recall correctly, this isn't, they're turning existing EVE Online onto blockchain. They're making a new game that will be on blockchain.
I don't know if that's 100% clear yet. I think it's 99% implied that it will be a different product. It doesn't seem feasible. I don't think it's tenable for them to transfer EVE Online to the blockchain. That's virtually impossible.
That's what has confused me about this. If you want to get something up and running as quick as possible, then why not take EVE as it is, all the assets you already have, and then just create a new shard? So EVE Online is now one shard. Why not just create a new blockchain shard? Seems like the cheapest way to land on the beaches in Normandy.
As long as the players still have the opportunity to do both, to still play on the old shard and the new shard, I think that's fine. I think if you make it exclusive, like you kill old EVE Online and now you can just play on the blockchain shard, then you cannibalize your player base, which would not be good. But yeah, I could definitely see them doing something like that. The reason I see them doing something like that, well, I guess the reason I see that being beneficial to them is that it's no secret that they've had trouble getting products that are not EVE Online out. And that's kind of what this PC Matt, so PC Gamer put an article out. You just Google PC Gamer, EVE Online, blockchain, you'll find the article. EVE Online Studio, CCP Games, is making a blockchain game. They emphasize this, this studio struggles to get anything that's not EVE Online out. So I believe they've had a couple of canceled projects in the last 5 years. I couldn't name them off the top of my head. They're pretty minor. Never ended up actually obviously being published, but not being successful. I do think it would behoove them to just make a shard, make EVE Online 2.0. I think there are a lot of people that are not that like very loud minority that would be interested in something like that.
So there's some context here that I think is interesting to go through. One thing that I would recommend reading is a great book called Internet Spaceships, Our Serious Business. It's a collection of published academic papers diving into the world of EVE Online and what EVE is and why people play EVE. And the number one thing I got out of reading that book, and I read it while I was on a 4X game on mobile, this canceled game called Breaking Bad Empire Business, was that people play Eve like it's a job, which sounds familiar, right? It sounds like play to earn, but they play it like it's a job and they have a deep sense of commitment to the community. So it's a lot of the cliches you normally hear. The other thing that I think is also interesting about Eve is that they've been ambitious and forward-thinking when it's come to how it monetizes. Eve is a subscription-based service, but the thing that it allows you to do is earn the points that you can use towards your subscription in a free way. It's something I believe it's called Plex Points. I believe World of Warcraft adopted something similar, but the subscription itself is a tradable asset. So that's the other thing that Eve has, is that it has assets that are tradable inside of the context of the game. So they have floating prices in some sense. Now, you can't MTX into those floating prices. So you can't just go and purchase hard currency like you would in any other game and then MTX into a $10,000 spaceship. So there's a lot of hierarchy that's been determined in Eve as a function of labor. So people have invested quite a large amount of labor into Eve to get a certain reward. And when you start to introduce real world money into that, there are going to be ramifications and it can change the social hierarchy, can move it, it can flip it upside down. And I think really interesting ways, and ways that if I were a member of the community and I were a laborer and I was sitting atop the social hierarchy and you started to introduce prices, that puts me at a disadvantage. Like, there are going to be winners and losers when you introduce real prices. And so what we think about, like, why communities have these reactions, is not everyone's a winner in a zero-sum game. The other thing I would point out is that Eve, despite the fact that it has subscriptions, has introduced MTX, but they've mostly been cosmetic. And the reaction to those cosmetic items, let's say, has not been calm. So there was a monocle that they introduced a while back that almost had an entire community riot against them. They removed that monocle, but they still have done really low-key items within the game, but they're non-gameplay affecting. So they haven't really had the experience that you might expect. When blockchain started to gain steam, everyone immediately pointed to Eve. Oh man, yeah, of course it makes sense for Eve. Eve has a really complex economy, and I think we continue to misunderstand what the blockchain is about. And what, you know, when we think about the blockchain, what is the blockchain? To me, it's just floating prices. It's floating prices. It's peer-to-peer exchange. It's buying and selling. It's auction houses. And to me, that's an effective way to monetize. I don't think it's more than that. And so when people just say, oh, deep economies, that must mean blockchain. Oh, Eve has a deep economy. Those things totally make sense. I don't see the connection. I don't see the connection. It is true. Like, they publish these really cool, interesting reports every single month. You can still look them up. They are probably deeper than the Federal Reserve will ever publish on, like, how many resources are being mined. But none of that has to do with MTX. None of that has to do with the blockchain. None of that is an open floating marketplace. It is a very separate environment with a particular set of incentives and a particular type of institution. So I'm just very skeptical that this is the natural fit that everyone thinks it is.
I really like the point about floating prices, because that's exactly how I've always seen this. I think even earlier in this conversation, I was talking about how this keeps calling it microtransaction, but this transaction fee environment, like this open economy where you've got these millions of transactions. I've always had this mental model, and I've even trying to formalize this into an actual model, that the value of the economy, think about EVE Online, people have valued that economy many times. I think it's worth in the tens of millions, if I'm not mistaken. If you do that conversion between the in-game currency and Plex, which has an actual real world value. So I always picture, like, this economy having some value, and that value is in free-to-play games and in premium games, that you can just measure that by how much money people have spent on it. So how much revenue did the game bring in? But with these open economies, that's probably going to be represented by transactions and the volume traded on the marketplace on a daily basis. So maybe we think about them like an annual scale, or maybe we think about it on a monthly scale. Now, the volume is going to be some percentage of that is going to go to the publisher. And that, to me, is that's how I view this monetization. I think of this marketplace as producing some amount of volume, and a subset or a fraction of that volume is the revenue that the firm gets. Now, as the game becomes less popular, as we enter year, how long has Eve been out? 20 years? They published in 2003, I think.
Wow, 20 years.
20 years old. And it's still a pretty vibrant economy. Highly, highly concentrated, right? We have like super devoted people, but that doesn't mean they're not willing to spend money on it. Take a game. What's a dead MMORPG?
Where to start? Cohen Online?
But take one of these. It's like how much money are they getting? I assume that the drop in the revenue that you get from these, from this market, from this volume share of the marketplace the firm is getting is going to be pretty equivalent or at least proportional to the drop in revenue that you get from a game like any other MMORPG that uses a traditional method. So to me, it's like, is CCP going to be better off implementing purely from the monetization standpoint? Are they going to be better off? Because for them, this only makes sense if they're going to make more money. If history has told us anything, they're not going to make more money just by releasing a new product. Okay, so there must be some sort of technological improvement that they believe they're implementing. Hey, EVE Online, we want you guys to put out a free-to-play version, which they did. I think you can play up to a certain level. You can level your characters up for free in EVE. That's going to improve our monetization, and it's going to grow our player base. What is the angle here? Are they going for increasing their market? Are they going for just diversification of their products? I'm really, like, I'd love to get into their heads and know what it is. Or are they...
A16Z, probably. Mark Andreessen is just up there, just in Iceland always, in their minds. One of the things you mentioned is this idea of taking cut of the transactions fee being some sort of revenue model. I don't see it. Don't see it at all.
Yeah, and I...
When you run these numbers, first of all, no one's done it. So there's an empirical point here, is that no one is actually making good money off transactions fees. And then you just do the simple matrix of, hey, what is my monthly trading volume? And then let's think about different rates of transaction taxes. And let's not even assume that there's going to be decline in trading volume due to the transaction tax, which of course we know there's going to be. But let's assume that away for a second. So if you had $10 million in monthly trading volume and you had a 10% tax, so you're making $1 million a month, that's $12 million run rate a year, which is nothing. So to get to something that anyone cares about, let's just for the sake of assumption, let's say, you know, you want to make $50 million a year as a live service game. That is a pretty good outcome. Now, that's still small potatoes. That probably puts you just... I would say at the entry point of Steam's top 20 list, probably 19th, 18th, probably doing around $50 million a year. So you're telling me if you want to make $50 million a year, and we can do this math right here, but if you want to make $50 million a year and you're going to do a 10% transaction tax, which would be absolutely batshit crazy. And if I had my calculator, I could actually figure out what these numbers
are. Here's where I push back a little bit. Here's the one problem I would say with your argument, Phil, is that you can't use, let's look at the revenue for Genshin Impact each month. That is not the equivalent to the trading volume that would happen if Genshin Impact were a blockchain game with an open economy. Presumably, under this model, and I'm actually arguing in favor of your idea here, but in this model, the transaction fee, you know, let's take a game right now that's pulling in $10 million in revenue a month. That game, if it were a blockchain game with a 10% fee, would have to have a volume of $100 million a month in order to like reach that same revenue. Now, from a marginal benefit point of view, a cost benefit analysis, willingness to pay from the consumer, blah, 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 like a very micro model you could write of this, you could say, oh, the players are spending $10 million a month. They're going to spend $10 million a month in net, whether it's open or not. So yeah, there's $100 million worth of revenue, but $100 million worth of trade volume, but $10 million of that is actually extracted as revenue and is the cost of the customer. So to me, I think that's the bigger question is like, what is the, and I don't think it's a behavioral question, but it is like, what is the mental cost? If I know that at the end of the month in net, I spent $10, but my transaction history, I just spent $100 and then I get $90 back. That's a very different economic decision than spending $10 because I have to spend it. There's uncertainty about what I get back. So this isn't, do you want to give me $10? It's, do you want to give me $100 and then I'll give you $90 back maybe in the future? So to me, that is where the friction is. It's this uncertainty of the transaction from the consumer's point of view. There's a whole bunch of uncertainty put into their calculation. So when we think about uncertainty, we think about discounting. How much do you discount the future? What are your risk preferences? You know, if you're very risk neutral or you're risk hating, this could not work. So it ultimately comes down to, from a micro point of view, it ultimately comes down to the risk preferences of the customers. Because if they are risk hating, then they are naturally going to not participate in that 100 to 90 to 10 transaction. They're more likely to participate in the $10 transaction, which would, in theory, mean that your revenue from a open economy would be worse than from a closed economy if your risk preferences of your customers is relatively risk-hating.
I did the math. You would need to do $41.6 million in trading volume per month at a 10% transaction fee. And again, 10% is batshit crazy. No one is doing 10%. Let's just assume that you're high end though. You're going to need to do $41.6 million in trading volume per month at a 10% transaction fee to make $50 million a year. And again, $50 million, an okay outcome. That is unbelievable in terms of trading volume. Very few people are doing that. I think Axie may have hit that at their height. So that is an incredible hill to climb. I still don't understand how you see that happening under the model you just described, though.
How would an open economy be revenue improving on a closed economy? And it would involve your customers to have, it would depend on their risk preferences. But I don't know if this 70 million in trading volume a month is out of the question. I think it all has to do with your player base. If you're Fortnite, that's a lot more realistic than if you're EVE Online, who has far fewer players than Fortnite.
Y'all are fixated on this transaction fee model. They don't necessarily have to monetize that way. They could do a corporate income tax or a land value tax or like any other kind of tax scheme to revenue, right?
Do you not see, I've always looked at this transaction fee as a tax, as a sales tax.
It is, but you could tax something else.
I see what you're saying.
But see, that's still GDP. Like everything is just, it's just, okay, what slice of the GDP equation do you want to apply a small percentage on? And for any of those things to work, you need that GDP number as an absolute value to be something batshit crazy. And like where that still depends on the game having some insane GDP. And none of these games have insane GDP to the rate at which you can make decent money. Like we're focusing on transaction tax and transaction volume. But where is that corporate income? How would you imagine a different GDP tax being implemented? How would you do that?
Yeah, I guess sales is probably the most direct because everything action is a sale. But I don't know. Let's say, my loose understanding is Eve, they have corporations, right? Self-organized groups, and there's like a hierarchy in them. And these corporations have their own bank accounts and warehouses and stuff. And if somehow you could all corporations to register the central government, you know, everything's on chain, so you can track exactly how much they're making and how much is getting distributed. But yeah, I suppose that would be a lot bigger headache. And to your point, right, it's all proportional to GDP anyway. And yeah, that
I agree. I think like having some sort of corporate tax is actually really clever because it also doesn't impact the low earners or the like low intensity players. So you have less churn for them. So maybe you just shift the distribution or shift the tax to tax the higher end of the distribution more. But to me, that's more of a methodological question. Like, okay, once this game is up and running, we get a data science team to evaluate this question. Okay, what's better? Tax the corporations or tax the little guys?
I think it has to be first party sales. And like having a marketplace, just the expectation, I think we talked about this at some point, but just having the expectation of a marketplace that I can flip an item means that even if Wizards of the Coast charges $3 per pack, if the average value of a pack opening is more than $3, people are going to continue to buy packs until they've introduced enough supply into the Magic the Gathering marketplace such that each pack is worth $3. There's an equilibrium there. So just the expectation of a marketplace and the idea I can flip these items means that Wizards of the Coast is going to experience all of these sales where people just bid it down to whatever the price is. So here's another brain teaser. Does it even fucking matter what Wizards of the Coast sets the price of a pack is? Pack at?
I think it does. I think it reduces the amount of supply in the player base.
Once they're fixed supply, it matters. But when they're unlimited supply, I don't think it has as much of an impact.
But if you set it at a penny, and let's say there were a million Magic the Gathering players, and Wizards of the Coast said, okay, it's going to be a penny, then you would buy a shit ton. You'd buy a shit ton. There'd be supply side problems. Basically, you're setting how much supply is going to be in the marketplace then if you're Wizards of the Coast by setting the price of the pack, right? Because if you set it at a penny, that means, and there's a ton of, like the amount of Magic the Gathering players is fixed in the short run. They're going to buy a shit ton of packs. There's going to be a ton of supply. And they're going to bid it down to a penny then, the average pack. And that means your supply curve is going to shit fucking out.
That's the number of Magic the Gathering players in the short run. I think that's the key assumption. If they're price sensitive, right? If you quadruple the price of all constructed decks.
I mean, what's really interesting is like they're even Magic's economy is moving away from like the pack economy with Magic Arena.
That to me is then the puzzle for Web3 is that you have two products that are digital for Magic the Gathering. One is Magic the Gathering Online, which has a marketplace and has been a disaster. Now it's a disaster because the UX has been an absolute shit show for 10 years. But that being said, they didn't introduce a marketplace in Magic the Gathering Arena. It is very similar to the Hearthstone model. They decided they didn't want to deal with any of that. And I think that calls into question some of the value of having a marketplace if they're not going to go ahead and do it. And they seem to be doing great.
So this primary market idea, I think a lot of, trying to think of a video of a crypto game that hasn't done that, hasn't had primary sales of NFTs. I think all the major ones have. Primary sales up until the market value is, so the market value is super low. So instead of going through the packs, you go on the secondary. So you start buying up the secondary, and the secondary starts to, the price goes up because you're buying up. It's one of the difficulties with this model is this model is okay when you're seeing player growth. It's hard to get player growth when you don't have a game. You have kind of this push and pull, and it's hard once you've put a lot of supply out, it's hard to take it back. I always use like a salt and like cooking and salt, or you add too much salt to the dish. Like you can't take that back. It's too salty. Whereas you can always add a little salt in. So that's how I look at these markets, like the primary market. It's like once those are out there, that's great. If your player base is growing, there will be sufficient demand to soak up the secondary until the secondary price increases past the primary price. Okay, people start buying primary again. And we have this nice balance, assuming that there's a healthy player base.
See, this is where I think you're wrong, though. I think you can take back the salt. I think you can take the salt. And I think Magic the Gathering does it, right? Magic the Gathering does it by introducing new sets. That is how they take off the salt. Because what happens is that the set that's relevant to the player is always shifting. And so in some sense, that's almost a reduction in supply. It's a reduction in the supply of cards that are relevant.
Oh, you're...
And I think MMOs do this too, right?
It's the like depreciation, they are able to introduce, right?
Yep, the capital depreciation. They're able to introduce repair costs. There's durability.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. It can be done,
but no one in crypto is really doing it. They're just fucked.
This is why, like the econ department, my econ department, we always joke. I want ship destruction so bad. Like the moment we can destroy ships, that's what I want. To bring this supply in check and give consequences to these things, but.
All right. Speaking of consequences, we have news last week that the competition authority from the United Kingdom has decided to not move forward with the Activision-Microsoft merger. They have cited cloud gaming or potentially Microsoft's domination of cloud gaming through the acquisition of Activision as the reason to prohibit the merger, that in some sense, if Microsoft were able to own Activision, they could potentially make some of Activision's games exclusive to streaming, I guess, to xCloud. It's really confusing. In the article, they seem to confuse Xbox Game Pass, which is their subscription service, with their streaming opportunity. And those things are tied together. Microsoft offers you the opportunity on Xbox Game Pass to stream games, but you don't necessarily need to. Can down them as full price products. And of course, they also have this on PC. So I think we know that this is just absolutely bullshit in terms of reasoning from the CMA. I think what's interesting here, and I got into this a little bit on another podcast that shall not be named, but what is Microsoft's strategy when it comes to streaming and when it comes to platforms? So a while back, I wrote two pieces, one of which is called The Economics of Game Pass Demand a PlayStation Launch. And so what I would argue here is that when you are in a subscription business, you have, I think, you've in some sense capped yourself in the sense that you cannot maximize the total willingness to pay for a given good or service. And Chris, you were just mentioning this. And this is something that I think games have done really well, which is to correlate the price of a good with the utility that you get from it, which is what MTX does. It's an ongoing ability for you to express that purchase so we can get to those kind of high marginal utility curves. But when you're in a subscription world, the only thing you want to do is you want to retain people on the subscription. That's goal number one. And goal number two is you want to increase the N or the number of subscribers as much as possible. And the reason that you want to do both of those things is that you can distribute all of your costs amongst those customers. So the larger your customer base on a monthly basis, the more that you can distribute those costs. And so when you think about it, as early as 2010, Netflix only had 20 million subscribers, suggesting a user cost of $5 for a $100 million production. So $5 per month for a $100 million production. And so that's pretty incredible just to think about, something that's $100 million. When you think about Amazon, which just spent a shit ton of money on Citadel, I think it was around $300 million. This is a TV streaming show they did with the Russo brothers out of Avengers fame. You know, when you amortize the cost of $300 million across the batshit crazy number of Prime subscribers, you know, it's cents, it's peanuts, you know, maybe 10 cents, 20 cents. And so if you're Microsoft and you're really into streaming, you're really into the subscription, or excuse me, you're really into subscription, the next thing you want to do is that you want to increase N. And so what is the thing that's preventing you from increasing N? Well, it's a $500 box called the Xbox. Being in the console business sucks. It totally reduces your addressable market. And so what is the solution? Well, it's streaming. Streaming is something that lets you be platform irrelevant. You can be anywhere. You can be on mobile. You can be on desktop. You can be anywhere you need to be. Streaming opens up the total addressable market potentially to anyone who exists on the planet without any $500 piece of hardware. Now, the problem with this is that, of course, you need the internet connection to be able to do streaming. But the second benefit to this is that it's an 11-foot pole to Apple's 10-foot wall. Because the thing you can do with streaming is that you can totally bypass all of these app stores. So if you can trigger streaming in the browser, which is what Microsoft has done on mobile, that means you can avoid all of the App Store restrictions. And if Apple chooses to somehow prevent the browser from letting you stream, that's when I think you'd have antitrust activists in the United States, even on the right side of the political aisle, going batshit crazy if they were to disable something on the web. That would be viewed as completely anti-competitive. But that's kind of bent their 11-foot ladder to the 10-foot pole is, hey, we're going to take streaming and we're going to bypass all of this Apple bullshit. And so not only can you get your total addressable market to nearly anyone, which means that you can amortize all of the costs of games, but the other thing you do is you can get past all the bullshit that comes with app stores. So anyways, this is what I think Microsoft's strategy has been for a really long time, is that if they can get the streaming piece right, and at the end, they have the tools, they have Azure. That's been Satya's main play, has been to get cloud and Azure up there. And that is Microsoft's, that is their business right now. If you look at their P&L, what is the thing that makes everyone super excited on Wall Street? It's Azure. Azure makes a shit ton of money. Their cloud business is absolutely killing it right now. And so it feels like you have all these natural synergies. You have Azure, you have a cloud business that's killing it. We have Xbox. We have all these problems with Xbox right now. It's in a distant third place. Like, this is the big bet, is that we're going to get a shit ton of subscribers. We're going to amortize costs. We're going to put it on streaming and we're going to get past the app stores. And this is our strategy to win. This is how we beat Microsoft, or excuse me, this is how we beat Apple. This is how we beat Sony. This is how we beat Nintendo. Okay.
If you really love and are addicted to the free-to-play model and you're like, I just really need those, maybe multiple tiers. I mean, Xbox, not with their streaming platform, but with, you know, their subscription service, they already have multiple tiers. Lots of subscriptions are starting to have multiple tiers. Netflix just, I think Netflix has four tiers. Yep. They have an ad-based tier now. So I think there's also a way to still cut into that consumer surplus like we were talking about with a little bit of variability there, providing different services. But
when you remember consumer surplus, right? It's the point above P. It's the difference between P and wherever you're sitting on your demand curve, right? And so when you introduce a new tier into the subscription, it's a square, right? Visually, it's a square. And so you're trying to, it's almost like you're doing Tetris. And so you're trying to fit enough squares underneath there so you can capture that consumer surplus. But doing this with subscriptions, it's still a fixed price. So the shapes that you can introduce into that consumer surplus to do Tetris are not as sexy or as voluptuous as MTX, as something that has a marginal pricing, as something that has an auction house. So it's always going to be fudged. You're always going to leave shit on the table that I think gaming can capture.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we think about the consumer surplus and extracting some of that, you can almost look up, it's like a step function. If you were to graph it out, Econ 101, you're saying even with the subscription tiers, you have these big triangles that are basically the gaps between tier one, tier two, tier three, and the microtransactions. Literally, it's a perfect line. It's smooth because you have every single, you have the ability to, well, I want to spend $13.25, not just $13.
You're pricing at marginal benefit.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a really great point. That said, 30% gain in revenue because you're avoiding fucking app store fees is, I guarantee it's bigger than that, that lost revenue.
I've never heard a price discrimination described as voluptuous before.
We write.
Is that what we want to call this one? The voluptuous episode?
The voluptuous consumer surplus.
Oh my God. That's it right there, Chris.
Yeah, man. Yeah, no, that was elegantly said. You're well said. I had a couple other thoughts, but.
So I think the consumption model for games is also quite a bit different from, you know, videos. You mentioned this in your articles. You know, I think for box games, especially for these kind of single session indie games, like it works. But for these highly replayable games, whether it be roguelikes or live service games, right, people tend to go super hard on for an extended period of time. the mega bundle of Netflix doesn't really work for that model, right? So like, I feel like even if it does take off, they're only capturing the sort of, I'm going to call it box price single player narrative games. They're not all narrative, but you know, the single linear experience. Then when you're done, you're done. Yeah, that's only a fraction of the market.
I mean, do you think that it gives incentives to produce these live service, like infinitely replayable games?
Yeah.
Do you think that it gives incentives to produce these live service, like infinitely replayable games?
I mean, I think it might help out because there's the flood of these indie games, right? And so this is the thing. I actually looked at Xbox Game Pass and I was, oh, actually, maybe I want to buy this because I want to play Hi-Fi, which is like an indie game. And these other indie games on here, you know, I play for a couple hours and then I turn it off and switch to the next one. And this actually works great for me in that realm. But if I like live service on my esports, so this doesn't make any sense for those.
What if you think about a subscription as an internal free-to-play network? So, of course, like you have an upfront fee. But once you're into the subscription network, everything's zero marginal cost. So if I want to play Hi-Fi Rush or I want to play, what's another game that's on the subscription? If I want to play Fallout for, like, once I'm in the network, it's free to play. Is there anything to that idea? I don't know. It's just been baking.
Yeah, it seems a lot more expensive to produce a new indie game as opposed to producing an additional, like the live service, once you've got people in there, like the amount of extra gameplay you get from an incremental piece of content is like much more efficient than producing a whole world, a whole visual style, a whole set of game mechanics. But so I want to talk a little bit about like why Microsoft wants to acquire Activision Blizzard in the first place, right? Like what they're getting out of this deal. So obviously Activision has a games, right? It's massive block. And on the Blizzard side, like I don't know if they would pull all the Blizzard ecosystem into their subscription. The Warcraft IP, Blizzard is sitting on a whole bunch of IPs that they've frankly been squandering. Kind of, it almost seems like a Disney Star Wars situation to me, where like, they're like, hey, this IP is super valuable and you guys completely fail to turn out games a bit. Like, we want to go into metaverse and all that. Like, this is a huge opportunity. You know, that's what I've been hearing at Blizzard. And then the King part is kind of just like a random on. Like, I don't think they actually care that much about Candy Crush. I think that's
Dude, always the King slander in this. This has been nothing but King. It's like, oh, yeah, there's.
Yeah, like the Candy Crush, what do they do? Like pull that into
Eric Seifert, I think, has a pretty interesting piece which basically argues that you can do an ad on a network. You can like shit into an ad network just because Candy Crush has so many different users. Maybe you can do some cross promo stuff. You know, there might be something there, but I think you're kind of
I mean, it's not like Activision's taking advantage of that. I mean, advertise your military. But yeah, maybe Microsoft could make
that, those are compliments. We talked about this episode one. Those are compliments. The perfect
scuttlebutt is the Blizzard part of the acquisition is more of like a metaverse, like ID acquisition play, as that part is more like, you know, getting goals for their Game Pass or, you know, their platform exclusives or what have you.
So if I were to summarize, though, like, what do you think the acquisition is about? You think it's just like getting more exclusive content for Game Pass?
I think the Activision part of it is content for Game Pass. I think the Blizzard part of it is the IP. And they'll probably take it and farm it out to their other studios the way they did with Halo. Or I mean, I don't know, right? But yeah.
This is going to make me sound really naive, which I am on this topic, but this is a huge deal. This is one of the biggest deals. I mean, this is the biggest deal in video game history. It's the biggest in video game history. One of the biggest in tech industry in general. Like, it is huge even in tech. So how is Activision Blizzard worth that much money? I think about the Scopely acquisition, which was like $4.5 billion or something like that. I don't understand. Like, what's the infrastructure? Do they have infrastructure? Do they have, what are they buying here? It's a mind-boggling number.
Hey, man, it's Overwatch. Overwatch League is worth a lot of money these days. Don't slander Overwatch League like that. And
I'll happily slander Overwatch League. Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about valuing companies or acquisitions. It definitely seems high.
It could potentially bolster Game Pass quite a bit, and maybe it does go into the streaming service. Do you want to talk more about the streaming thing?
And I heard as part of the antitrust thing, like one of the stipulations was that Microsoft was not allowed to reduce the pass of their Game Pass too much. Like they were required to keep the price sufficiently high to be competitive.
So they've had dollar price promos for Game Pass for quite some time. So this is another interesting point. So Microsoft has been reporting Game Pass numbers, Game Pass MAU numbers, quarter over quarter for quite some time. They stopped doing that a year ago, which I thought was interesting. And it also somewhat coincided with the ending of their dollar price promo. for Game Pass. So if you could spend a dollar, and I think it was like for 3 or 4 months.
Oh, it's over? I missed it. Damn.
Yeah, it was something else. And I do wonder, since they've gotten rid of that price promo, if MAU is still growing at the rate they think it's growing. Because they also started to push a lot more about Xbox Game Pass PC, which is interesting as well, where they did this price promo. But it's, I don't think it's looking great. The number don't, I don't think they're growing anymore. If they ain't talking about it, I don't think it's growing anymore.
How many are on Games Pass compared to Live? Is it like 10 million on Games Pass, 90 million on Live or something like that?
I want to say 60 million.
Oh.
But that might have been an article for a couple years ago.
There's going to be a lot of editing. All right. So I have 2022. I have 25 million MAU on Game Pass.
Oh.
That's higher than I thought.
Holy shit. Yeah.
And they have 120 million MAU total. So you're seeing around 15 to 25% of people that use Xbox on a monthly basis are subscribers to Game Pass, which is actually quite higher than I expected.
Really? I always thought the marginal cost was pretty low compared to the marginal benefit. I think, isn't Game Pass is 15 and Live is 10?
Game Pass includes PC too, I imagine.
Oh, okay. Yep. So it gives you a whole bunch of other content. Because I always just do the calculation. I'm like, okay, how much money did I spend on games last year? How much is Game Pass? Am I getting most of the games that I would play? I've been lucky so far to be getting most of those. If they add more to their Game Pass through Activision Blizzard, like, that's the type of scale that makes these types of deals, in my opinion, very difficult to understand and quantify. That when you combine these two things that weren't combined before, all of a sudden you're extracting a lot more money. Add a bunch of Activision Blizzard's content into the Game Pass deal, you're talking about a lot more money than like Activision Blizzard in a box. You combine those two things and you get scale that isn't really measurable. And it's what makes me so confused about antitrust to begin with.
So just to run through the Xbox pricing strategy right now, or the Game Pass pricing strategy. So for $10 a month on console, you can get your base level Game Pass subscription. And so what that's going to allow you to do is it's going to allow you to play any of the catalog of games that are on Game Pass at no additional fee. The other thing it's going to do is it's going to get you, this is interesting, they have this across all tiers, is they give you benefits for Riot games. So they're starting to give you some benefits, even if you're a player of a free-to-play game. You're going to get some sort of dividend payment. So you can pay $10 a month on console for that. They have a separate PC subscription, which is also $10. It's about the same thing. The only thing that the PC is going to give you over the console is that it also gives you EA Play by default, which is interesting. And so EA Play is the EA subscription that is equivalent to Game Pass. It gives you day in and day one access to all of EA's games. You can pay $15 a month, which is going to get you both PC and console Game Pass subscription. And here's the other thing that you get with Ultimate. This is where you're going to get the cloud. Not only are you going to get the cloud, but you're also going to get Xbox Live Gold, which is what you need to be able to play console games on Xbox that are not free to play. So if you wanted to play Call of Duty, which is not a free-to-play game, you would need to have Xbox Live. That's $15 a month. So to me, this looks like they really just want to throw numbers at this. They want to get N as high as possible.
Yeah, and it might work. I just realized I'm paying for the wrong plan. I don't need also PC. I just went into my account. I was like, what the fuck? Anyway.
Console's dead? Do you want to talk about consoles are dead?
Oh,
are consoles dead? What are you talking about?
They're not dead, but I think they're trending down, and I think they'll continue trending down.
What? We've never sold more this generation.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just super out of the loop.
Really?
Any other console.
All right, Nintendo's its own weirdo.
If you track sales on a cohorted basis, so like day since release, you kidding me? This generation has completely destroyed every other generation.
Yes,
we can just do it on a per firm level. So we can just look at PlayStation 5 versus any other PlayStation on a quarter basis. This thing has absolutely wrecked every other PlayStation. And only that, it's done with fucking supply issues too.
Wow.
So there's unmet demand. Here, we can search. I'm speaking very confidently right now, and I'm very confident, but I don't have the numbers off the top of my head.
No, I believe it. But okay, so I see where Eric's coming from. Gen Z is not really into hardware. Like, they like their phones and they like to play on their phones. They like to interact with very like hyperactive content. Consoles don't really provide that. So is that the line of thinking, Eric? Like, eventually most gaming will be mobile gaming. That's why streaming is so much better, because you can't really actually have a huge rig on your phone. That's my line of thinking. And I would explain away the increase in sales right now to the fact that all of the millennials and older Gen Zers who have played console for their entire lives, their kids are starting to get old enough to play with them. And so they're buying those for the kids. And because at least my parents' generation definitely didn't give a shit about video games or consoles, not nearly as much as our generation.
My thought is, the console is a specialized computer designed specifically for playing games. And it was from an era where computers sucked and nobody were expensive, and high-end home computers were rare. And over time, as people get more and more, better general computing, that kind of absorbs the specialized computing market. And I think we saw this in handheld games where, Game Boys and PS Vitas or whatever the fuck, like, over time just got absorbed by mobile. Nintendo saw the writing on all this. So that's what the Switch is, right? It's a hybrid handheld. And my prediction is that we'll see the same trend console, that they'll gradually get absorbed, between mobile and PC gaming. The general computing hardware will surpass the specialized computing hardware.
Yeah. But the prices are decreasing. They're not increasing. So that kind of explains that, Eric, your kind of substitute for PC argument, I guess. I don't know what you would call that, but they were an answer to a problem, and now they're not necessarily an answer to a problem. Although I would argue they are. I prefer playing on my couch in front of my TV. So I have a console. I have a computer that could play video games. I don't play a lot of video games on my console or on my computer. At least it's not my preferred version. But streaming is really interesting. Like, all of our apps, we don't need a Roku anymore. We don't need like an extra box to get our TVs to work. Our TVs have all these smart apps built into them, and we just stream everything. Why not for video games?
Tim Sweeney had a really great response to this about something to do with latency and how computers work, and like, the rate at, because here's the thing, here was the reason, right? So when you think about movies, the amount of data that you have to stream for a movie is a fairly constant. There's a very easy switch on streaming movies, which is the quality of the picture. So even though The Avengers has so much more CGI than, let's say, It's a Wonderful Life, if they are both in 4K, they are going to be the same amount of data to transfer. Whereas when you think about a video game, that's not always the case. So those 2D games we were talking about at the top of the hour, what is it, Turmeric?
Dude, you've been cooking too much Eastern, Middle Eastern food. It's not turmeric, it's tunic. Oh my God.
Tunic. All right. So tunic, is it going to require less of a data transfer than, let's say, Call of Duty? And so you are going to have this race where internet speeds are going to need to constantly increase at a rate that is consistent with the growth and the graphical fidelity of. So like ray tracing came out recently. You're going to need an increase in speed in terms of your internet connection to be able to render that. Whereas when it comes to the quality of films, like, we've gotten ahead of that race. Like, technology has gotten ahead. Internet speeds, the increase in internet speeds have outpaced the increase in graphical fidelity of film, whereas in gaming, internet speeds are not on a growth path that lets them overtake the increase in graphical fidelity from games, and it doesn't appear that those growth rates will ever supersede one another. And so game streaming will never work, according to Tim Sweeney.
So on top of that,
a lot of paraphrasing.
On top of that, there's the latency issue, right? Most people, TVs are on Wi-Fi, and if you have a quarter, movies can buy, so you can buffer ahead 50, if you have a quarter second delay in Magic Arena, that's fine. But if you have a quarter second delay on your dialed in ring, you die, right?
And you get the speed of light problem, right? So you literally can't solve the lag input problem, because the speed of light is always going to be the maximum rate at which you can transfer input and lag.
Yeah, but on Earth, that's not really an issue.
I will say, for the majority of the market and for most of the single player narrative in these bundles, these subscription bundles, it's probably fine. Like, for God of War, if you have a quarter second delay, it's not a huge deal. For these high intensity, high act games, like, I play Celeste on, inconsistent.
Did either of you guys ever get a chance to try Stadia when it was out?
No.
Or OnLive? No one talks about OnLive anymore. Ahead of its time.
No. I think I played two or three streaming games, and they were single player racing games. Input latency.
Racing games makes them, it's pretty cool. Like if you look at, I don't know if you played Mario Kart Wii, but the Wii had terrible netcode, but Mario Kart Wii played fine because they had really good like interpolation for predicting other drivers' paths and stuff.
Oh, interesting. So like from my limited experience, the only issue that I had was with the graphical component where it was just like, I was like getting 320p the whole time. It was terrible. But yeah, the latency issue, like for League, you don't really need that much graphical computing power to run that game.
No, it's the packet loss and that matters.
Yeah, exactly.
Do we want to call it, do a wrap?
I got sued.
Oh.
Game Economist Cast, Episode 8, Voluptuous Consumption in the Can.
Remind me to tell you about our Super Layers OnlyFans.
Oh,
man, that would be an amazing cold open.
Do a whole episode on that.
All right, Eric, tell us, what is OnlyFans crypto look like?
We should teach this to our children. Economics is major. Everyone has to major in economics. Number one, for personal survival. Economics is major.